Hi, I'm Guy Leschtzner, author of Seven Deadly Sins, The Biology of Being Human. In my day job, I'm a clinical neurologist and a professor of neurology and sleep medicine based in London. Like many of my colleagues who work in brain health, I regularly meet people in my clinics whose behaviours, emotions and social interactions have all been moulded or altered by damage or disease, where conditions like brain tumours, trauma or degenerative disease have fundamentally changed the nature of that person, or to frame it in a slightly different context, have tilted their moral compass. In their cases, where catastrophic damage to their brains is to blame, they can't be held accountable for their acts. Instead, they're victims of pathology. Their change in behaviour is directly attributable to a change in their brain structure or function. However, this also has broader implications. For all of us, how we act, the decisions that we make, these are also influenced by the function and structure of our brains. Therefore, for each and every one of us, perhaps there are countless biological reasons for why we behave in the way that we do. For millennia, our actions of wrongdoing have been framed as sins, as exemplars of immorality, of evil. Most famously, these have been defined as the seven deadly sins, originally by Pope Gregory I, then immortalised by Dante in the Divine Comedy. Wrath, gluttony, lust, envy, sloth, greed, and pride. The seven deadly sins constitute the basis of all human evil. And it's not just Christianity. All other major religions have variants of this concept. In my book Seven Deadly Sins, I introduce you to several people, all of whose sinful behaviour has been driven by factors outside their control, by influences on brain function or structure that lead them to act in ways that would be characterized as these seven deadly sins. I also show you how these factors affect us all, and that these deeds are woven into the tapestry of humanity, serving important aspects of our survival. I'm going to share with you five key insights from my book. Number one, brain diseases and their treatments can all influence sin. Number two, factors affecting our behaviour can be present from the moment of our conception. Number three, environmental circumstances exert an influence on our sins even from before we are born. Number four, sins have their biological advantages and have evolutionary imperatives. Number five, boundaries between the normal and the immoral, between the physiological and the pathological, are blurred. Insight number one. Brain diseases and their treatments can all influence sin. Anyone who has ever prescribed, or indeed had a prescription for a medicine, knows that all pills have potential side effects. Sometimes these side effects are physical, but occasionally medicines can fundamentally change our actions. Drugs used to treat Parkinson's disease, for example, can make us more impulsive, amplifying our sexual desires, or even changing our sexual preferences, or make us eat compulsively. These medications alter the chemistry that underlies those circuits of the brain that mediate pleasure and reward. Steroids, widely used for inflammation, can result in dramatic grandiosity, inflating our sense of self-importance. Certain anti-seizure medications can cause catastrophic elevations in wrath and resultant aggression, changing people's lives for the worse. These drugs change the functions of the brain through their effects on circuitry that mediates our emotions and our actions. But changes to the structure of the brain too, also affecting those regions that are responsible for driving or inhibiting our behaviours, can have similar results. Tumours, stroke, trauma, degeneration, all of these can cause hypersexuality, extreme overeating, pathological envy or pride, an inability to control our basic impulses. Studying these individuals provides important insights into those brain regions responsible for our day-to-day behaviour and how it can go awry. Insight number two. Factors affecting our behaviour can be present from the moment of our conception. For some people, the genes that we inherit from the first spark of life can have profound effects on our future personality. One gene, known as the warrior gene, can affect our levels of aggression. In fact, to such an extent that variants in that gene, called MAOA, have been used as a mitigation for people convicted of violent offences, including murder, sometimes successfully. Mutations of this gene can result in a syndrome causing males to be highly prone to violent outbursts, often resulting in criminality, including rape, arson, and murder. Our genetic inheritance may also have surprising impacts on the way that we interact with our environment. One genetic variant associated with aggression has been associated with increased rates of gun carrying pre-9/11, but did not seem to have an impact after 9/11, when threat levels were elevated. Similarly, variety of both common genes and rare mutations can transform our appetite and propensity to weight gain. In the book, I introduce you to Alex, a young woman whose genes have changed the way a small area of her brain, called the hypothalamus, functions. She's destined never to sate her hunger, to always feel ravenous, to eat without limits. Insight number 3. Environmental circumstances exert an influence on our sins, even from before we are born. The Jesuits knew well the effects of our upbringing on our future behaviours. The founder of the Jesuit order famously stated, "Give me a child until he is 7, and I will give you the man." But we now know that our childhood can fundamentally shape our brains, and in that way define our character. One of the most potent forces shaping our personalities is parental influence. Grow up in a stressful or traumatic environment, and this predisposes to increased aggression or anger, for example. Those people with problematic aggression show structural differences in parts of the brain responsible for emotional regulation, as well as changes in brain biochemistry. Childhood adversity may directly affect brain development through its effect on hormones and how our genes are regulated. Similarly, parenting style has been shown to have major effects on our personality traits, like narcissism. While we think we may be encouraging self-esteem in our children, overpraise, over-evaluation of how special our children are, results in narcissism rather than self-esteem. Our environment may not just be important in our first few years of life. It appears to also affect us before we're born. In the winter of 1944, the Netherlands were gripped by famine. Initially, this was triggered by the Nazis. They banned food transports in punishment for a call to strike by the Dutch government in exile, an effort to support the Allies marching across Western Europe. But a harsh winter followed, meaning that the canals that usually permitted the transport of food from the rural east of the country to the urban west froze over. The average food intake dropped from 1,800 calories to 400 to 800 calories, and affected everyone, children and pregnant women included. The aftermath of this period was surprising. Long-term follow-up of those children born to mothers who had been pregnant during the famine showed some startling results. Depending on when in the pregnancy the mothers starved, children showed different responses. Those who were in the latter stages of pregnancy produced underweight babies, who remained small in adulthood. However, those starving in the first stages of pregnancy produced normal-weight babies who grew up to be more obese with higher rates of cardiovascular disease. The conclusion was that starvation very early in our development causes changes in our vital organs that influence how we consume and process food. Insight number 4. Sins have their biological advantages and have evolutionary imperatives. For all the personality traits that form the basis of the 7 deadly sins, there are people that sit at the extremes. For the majority of us, we have moderate levels of every single one of these traits. They're the basis of what it means to be human, and each of them serve biological imperatives. Without lust, we're destined not to reproduce, to become extinct. Without gluttony, we'll starve in times of famine. Without jealousy, we risk raising children that are not our own, or lose the support of a partner. Greed drives us to advance, to acquire, to gain resources that fuel survival. Even the thought of money promotes self-sufficiency in psychological studies. Sloth reflects the constant calculation of, is it worth it? Will the energy I burn be worth the reward at the end of any particular task? Pride and anger drive success, the defence of our resources in the face of threat, and the persistence to achieve. If these traits promote survival and the passing on of our genes, it's understandable why these aspects of our personality are promoted, why they're intrinsic to all humanity. What's less intuitive is why we have developed mechanisms to rein these features of our species in. Surely, if these aspects promote our success, why then do we not have very heightened sinful natures? Proposed origins of the need to regulate these characteristics are somewhat surprising. If we compare our tendency to violence to those of our nearest living relatives, bonobos and chimpanzees, it's very different. This implies that evolution has shifted the way that we exhibit violence, some pressure that has limited our potential for aggression in the face of threat. One intriguing explanation for this is our ability to communicate and conspire, for groups of humans to organise. We alone among our family of species can kill those alpha males who step beyond the pale, who are too violent or too aggressive. That through our elimination of people who show too much violence, we have shaped the violence profile of our species. Likewise, when it comes to lust, why do we not just reproduce with abandon? Why do we limit who we have sex with? Beyond more instinctive reasons, such as ensuring good genetic health in our offspring or avoidance of sexually transmitted infections, there are other more surprising explanations. Some researchers propose that one of the main reasons for long-term mating in humans is that human females do not provide overt clues that they're ovulating. In chimpanzees, ovulation is accompanied by a swelling and pinkening of their genitals, while in humans there are no clear signs. Identifying women in good health, who are fertile, is much more problematic for human males. One solution is to find a female partner of high reproductive value and have sex repeatedly, at some point hopefully around ovulation. One solution is to find a female partner of high reproductive value and have sex repeatedly, at some point hopefully around ovulation, to monopolise her reproductive resources and ensure healthy offspring. Insight number 5. Boundaries between the normal and the immoral, between the physiological and pathological, are blurred. Many of the individuals I detail in Seven Deadly Sins have very obvious brain pathology causing a change in their behaviour through their effects on brain structure. Brain tumours causing excessive pride, genetic conditions like Huntington's disease resulting in heightened sloth, or strokes triggering intense and excessive sexual desire. In these cases, all clearly visible on brain scans. For some of the other patients, their actions are related to changes in the functioning rather than the structure of the brain. Drugs causing personality change, genetic factors or diseases altering brain biochemistry, for example. For some, it is even the effects of their upbringing or other environmental triggers, such as pornography or sugary foods, altering those circuits in the brain that mediate pleasure and reward. How we define what constitutes diseases of the brain and diseases of the mind is not set in stone, and is to a large extent a function of medical technology and knowledge. In the days before medical imaging, most of the people who I describe in the book would have been characterised as having diseased minds or souls rather than brains, except for one or two who might have had brain abnormalities found at post-mortem. With the advent of X-rays, a few might have got brain diagnoses whilst alive. Then with MRI scans, many more would have shifted into this category. And as medical technology advances, and we begin to appreciate the various factors that influence the workings of our brain, genetics, environment, infections, our gut microbiome, etc., we'll identify more and more people whose personalities, whose actions, whose sinful behaviours derive from factors in whole or in part outside their control. And if that is the case, then it forces us to rethink the concepts of free will, of good and evil. An action can be categorised as such, but can a single individual, or is it purely a consequence of the summation of all these factors? Where is the boundary between evil and pathology? Who defines this? Is it a judge, a priest, a physician, or a neuroscientist? And as I've hinted at, there is a second blurred boundary, since these sins are all intrinsic to us and have major benefits. At what point does the amplitude or intensity of a personality trait become abnormal? After all, heightened narcissism can be helpful in certain walks of life, as can greed or wrath. Again, who defines the hard border between normal and abnormal? That's it from me. Thanks for listening, and I really hope you enjoy the book.